is now off hold. You have entered as an attendee in listen-only mode.
Al, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, David.
Good morning. A couple of little tidying up pieces of business before we start. The conference call should last about 45 minutes to an hour. I will act as an interlocutor to begin the call, and then we'll respond to questions. A bunch of questions have been emailed to me already. If you have other questions, please feel free to send them to me at drothberg@niagaracapital.ca. We don't always get to all the questions, but we usually manage to get to most of them. And before we get to the first one, in deference to Eddie Roth, the redoubtable Eddie Roth, who does such good work in organizing these calls, we have to announce the date. It's the 21st of April. Okay, Al, let's begin. My first question comes from the, and it's my own, but I'd like to think that I'm asking it on behalf of all your readers. In your quarterly report, you talk about the role that central banks, this unusual role that central banks are playing. And in the body of, I think in the second paragraph, you write that emboldened by the absence of immediately visible deleterious effects, these normally conservative bureaucratic bodies press ahead with their charismatic vision, making sure along the way to convert the blind and the lame. Now, charismatic, do you not find that that's just perhaps a little bit pretentious?
Well, you know, the truth is that they are out to try to save the world, and that's really what they want to do. Is they want to make sure that that nothing bad happens, and that every time there's a little hiccup, that they're going to be there. And so, really, the central bank activity in the past 3, 4, or 5 years has been incredible. We have never had anything like this in history. And it's you might call super active, and it's causing a tremendous amount of problems. Markets are having a difficult time in digesting it. You know, when you have precedents, then it's a lot easier to work. When you don't have any precedents, then the markets have to begin groping around, and they are groping for a stand. Where do we stand? Where do we stand in the relationship of equities to fixed income? Where do we stand in relationship of growth and inflation? It's all, and in fact, even the central banks don't know. So here we have a situation where nobody knows, really nobody knows, and we are experimenting. And so, but their main goal, of course, has been to try to smooth things and to ease the pain, quote unquote, of adjustment. And so, you know, I try to be as dramatic, but in fact, this is what happens. And this is what now the talk in market circles is not about reality, but it's about what the central banks will do next.
Yeah.
That's what they talk about. And central banks, probably among each other, they must be thinking, and they probably, I mean, we see that, they're thinking, what does the market think of what we are thinking? What does the market think of what we're doing? So this is a game. This is a real game. And fundamentals are being tossed aside because all we want to do is make people feel good and avoid pain. At any cost, avoid pain.
Priests, and the implication in charismatic is that the central bankers have a kind of priest-like quality to them, can act with the very best intentions, but can also become blinded to power. Do you think that both are at play here?
Yes, yes. At first, you know, they are called the high priest of finance, right? I mean, they are called that way, the high priest of finance. I think that they're timid people, usually. They're central bankers, like most government officials are, and like most bureaucrats, are timid. So they need to work, they need to work slowly. They need to build on each other's actions and confidence. And so, but they are now getting to places that we would have never believed they could get to. And this is remarkable. And of course, you know, it starts in one place, and then it's copied somewhere else, and then that becomes part of the jargon. And then we, you know, quantitative easing. I think anybody in the street, practically, you pick up some, you ask somebody in the street who is working in construction, and you say to him QE, and he knows it's quantitative easing. So it's become part of the language. It's become part of the understanding that this is what you got to do. Negative interest rates. 5 years ago, you would have thought that who would have thought negative interest rates were possible? And yet today, that's an acknowledged quote-unquote tool in their toolkit. It's insane. I have to tell you, it's insane. And we're all running around trying to figure out ways. How do we cope with this? How do we deal with this? How do we adapt to this? What does it mean? We know one thing. We know that we are building up a very large amount of credit and debt. That we know, and that's obviously the consequence of what they're doing. They are stimulating borrowings, and they are deferring. When you're stimulating, you're deferring adjustment. The healthy type of borrowing is borrowing that you borrow for productive purposes. The unhealthy type of borrowing is when you borrow for cash flow. And we are borrowing for cash flow very often. Very, very often we borrow for cash flow. We are borrowing to pay dividends. We are borrowing to buy back shares. We're not borrowing to build factories and to build things that we need. So what they're doing is, I said that we don't see the deleterious effects. We don't see them right away. That's true. We don't see them right away. Sometimes it takes a few years. But we are beginning to see it already now. For example, we have a much lower rate of productivity in the past few years. Everybody thinks it's puzzling. Well, it is puzzling. You know, how is it possible in this era of this digital era where we thought that we have invented the most extraordinary things? We have a slowdown in productivity. And the reason we have a slowdown in productivity is because very little money has gone into investments, into real investments. And a lot of the money has gone into speculation, financial speculation. This is all central bank induced, all of it central bank induced. The previous cycle, we had central banks inducing speculation in housing. In this cycle, we have central bank inducing speculation in a number of other things. So we'll find out at the end of it, we'll find out what was the problem. As usual, they will say they had nothing to do with this. This is what we did, we had to do. Greenspan today is still a hero. You know what he did by lowering rates to unconscionable levels and stimulating borrowings in massive amounts to buy real estate, to buy housing, created the housing boom and bust. But you know they will deny it, and they will deny the next thing that will happen again. But for now, we all try to cope, and it's very hard to cope. It's really very hard to cope. We are actually blind. We are blind. We walk in a room and we are blind, and we have to tap the walls to know where we are.
Al, before we talk about how you've been coping and how you've been negotiating, I want to, because I personally happen to be reading Kindleberger's book on manias and panics. This has all the makings, or to read it literally, this sounds like a credit bubble that's really even a larger one that resulted in the crash of 2008. But in its effects, we don't see a credit bubble or a bubble in assets as large as we saw in 2008. Is this going to end very badly? Is this going to end as badly as 2008 ended? Do we have to have some kind of obvious and very dramatic bubble in financial assets before this credit bubble reveals itself?
Well, you know what? I don't want to say it's going to certainly end badly. First of all, nothing in life is really predetermined. We can always change things, and we are very adaptable creatures, so we can manage to change. I think that the best that one can say is that we will have rolling crises. There'll be sectors that will, for example, we have a rolling crisis now in the energy area, right? I mean, a lot of money went into energy in the past few years. tremendous amounts of money went to finance, for instance, shale fracking, it was a bubble. It was a bubble, and the bubble bust when the price of oil went down. So that's one type of crisis, or one type of fall. We could have the same kind of thing happening for the next 10 or 15 years, where we have different industries, different sectors going through this kind of thing. It doesn't have to be a generalized type of generalized type of crisis. For example, regulators have been fixed upon the idea that the banking system is weak and vulnerable, and therefore they have to have more capital. They have to, and therefore, you know, if we can do that and we can make sure that capital is sufficient and that that it can withstand a lot of write-offs, we'll be in better shape. And I don't disagree that that's the case. The question is how to go about it. But it may not come from the banking side. We may not have a banking problem. We don't know in advance where these crises come from. It may come in the junk bond market, and I think it could come, and I think it will come in the junk bond market. I think that we have a highly overextended market that issued enormous amounts of credits, and very weak, even weaker than the standard junk bond. You can see that by recovery rates. Sorry, recovery rates today are lower than you ever were, and that's because the credits granted are of lower quality, even lower than what we normally consider junk bonds. And these bonds barely trade. Their inventories, funds are studded with these things. They have billions and hundreds of billions of dollars. Thank you, Danny, for the water. Thank you. Just let me clear my throat. Funds are full of these bonds. The day that people want to get out of these bonds, such a day will come, and I think that it will come when they get nervous about something, it will be difficult to liquidate those inventories. It will be very difficult to liquidate those inventories. And so the crisis may not be located at the banking side, but it will be located somewhere else. And so we may have a run on junk bonds. So, yes, it has to end badly, but it doesn't have to end in the same way. Things don't end always the same way. We don't have to have a depression. We don't have to have a great financial depression. We can have very low growth or stagnation for years to come, like we had in the 70s, and you can have crisis in different sectors and bankruptcies in different sectors, and the rates of return to investors will be either minimal or will be zero or will be negative.
You're painting a dark picture, or a tricky picture, at least, a tricky landscape for investors. And as you said, we're traveling in the dark now. And yet, despite that, you've managed to do well. You had a good quarter. You've had an especially good quarter in what's generally been regarded as the staid and very conservative asset allocation fund. It's actually outperformed the more highly leveraged, I wouldn't say highly leveraged, the leveraged global macro fund. Let's spend a little time talking about the neglected asset allocation fund, neglected in the sense that we don't typically on these calls talk about it. What explains our outperformance in the asset allocation fund?
Well, you know, the asset allocation fund is, as you say, stayed conservative in that it doesn't go short, it doesn't borrow money, and I would say that generally speaking, it does not, it doesn't bet on outcomes that are negative for asset prices. At best, if it felt that certain areas or maybe the entire world was coming to a deep recession, it may just go to cash. So it won't make money on large financial crises or large financial falls or crashes. It just will not make money in those kind of environments. And it's not designed to do that. It's designed just to say, where can I put my money today in the best possible way? Where can I allocate money today in the best possible way without betting necessarily or without trying to make money, let's say, necessarily on a cataclysmic event. And that's proven so far to be good. Actually, I have to say that that it's an interesting, it's a balance, it's an inner balance for me in a way, because I tend more towards calling more catastrophic type of events. And so here comes the asset allocation fund, and I say, okay, you know, things are going to hell, and what do you do now? And so, you know, what I say, okay, all I can do is go to cash or buy more bonds or things of that sort. It happened to be that the last, I think the fund has been around since 2009, so it's been around for 6 years. Or 7 years almost. It did well in this environment of muddling through. And in essence, what we have to say is that the economies of the world, the U.S., the world economy, the global economies, with all the problems that they've had, and with a huge reduction in the rate of growth, and sort of the very poor performance in terms of wealth creation, it has muddled through. Nothing terrifying has happened. We haven't had 14 or 15 or 18% unemployment. We haven't had the 30s. You know, even though they like to call the 2008 the greatest depression since the 30s, it wasn't. It really wasn't. Unemployment did not get high, did not get very high. There was a lot of layoffs in the financial industry, yes, of course. But it wasn't a catastrophe in real terms, in productive terms. But we're living through a period where there is very little growth, where there is very little credit creation, or I'm sorry, wealth creation, but we have muddled through. And in that muddling through scenario, interesting enough, asset allocation has done better, because it's designed almost to do that. You know? It's designed to take advantage of interesting areas and areas that are promising from a return point of view. But it's also designed, almost by deliberately designed, not to bet on catastrophes. And so you don't go short, and you don't buy puts other than sometimes to hedge a position. But we don't buy options to bet on that, on those happenings. And as I say, it's worked out relatively well. You know, again, it's a different. It has the same global macro view. It shares in the same global macro view. It's the same person, so I don't split my mind. I don't split my brain. I have the same thoughts, but in one, I am more restrained, let's say, and only looking to as I say, to buy good assets. And the other one, I'm interested in taking opportunity wherever I can find.
Thank you. Now, you're speaking about a world in which the basic architecture or the basic engineering of the world from an investor's point of view is weak. Since mid-February, markets have rallied strongly, especially actually since the second week in March when the Fed, the ECB, and the Chinese government all almost at the same time conspired to turn dovish.
Conspired is good. Yeah.
Would you say that would it be right to assume that the rally since then is a very short term response to something that and from a fundamental point of view just cannot continue? And does that explain why you remain, from an equity point of view, net short in the global macro hedge fund?
Right. What the central banks are doing is basically they're shots of insulin, right? They're shots of insulin, and that's what happened in mid-February, and the markets have taken that as a signal that again things can be moved forward, can be pushed forward. Things will be okay, and do I think that it has a natural end? It has a natural, let's say, it has a point in which they cannot go further. And I'll tell you what it is. Central banks are in charge of money and in charge of inflation. Those are their main mandate. So the U.S. has a dual mandate, I think, growth and inflation. But In reality, central banks around the world are in charge about the value of money and of course prices. This whole experiment will come to an end the moment that inflation rears its head and the moment that we get to see accelerating inflation. And I think that as long as we don't get to see that, they can continue doing what they're doing. And every so often, every time the market shows some weakness, every time it looks like something bad is about to happen, you'll have Draghi or somebody in Japan or Yellen or somebody come out and say, well, you know, I'm not sure about normalizing rates. I think that we're going to wait a little bit longer, or are we going to do some more buying of treasury. Now we're going to buy corporates. In Japan, they're talking about buying ETFs, stock ETFs. So I think all this they can act with impunity as long as inflation doesn't stare them in the face. Here, I want to just bring one interesting example. And I think that this should be a lesson to all central banks. Brazil adopted many years ago a price target. And the price target, I believe, was 4.5% inflation and 2% band on either side of the inflation rate. So they could allow it to get as high as 6.5%, or they could allow it to get as low as 2 or 2.5%. Before they needed to take action. You know, first, it was a fairly liberal kind of a target. I mean, 4.5% is not great. But coming from a South American country, a country that's had a history of a lot of inflation, I guess that was justifiable. But then they gave themselves margins, very, very significant margins. I mean, 50% margins, right? And yet, With that target in their face, they allowed the inflation rate to rise and go beyond that top, beyond the ceiling, beyond the 6 or 6.5%. They allowed it to go beyond it because that is the inertia of central banks. They have an inertia. They have also an asymmetric responses to these kind of things. They can easily react. Believe me, if the inflation rate in Brazil would have gone below 2 or 2.5%, they would have been there with gobs of money. But because it went the other way, it was asymmetric, and so they allowed it. And they thought, well, you know, maybe it's administrative prices that are doing this, or maybe it's the price of oil, or maybe, and they always found some excuse. Well, but in the end, you know. Thank God in the end, I don't know if I can say thank God in the end, but at any rate, in the end, prices did shoot right through the top, and then they went to 7, and then they went to 8, and then they went to 10, and then they went to almost 11%. And so when they got to 10%, they realized that, well, you know, we can't keep doing what we were doing. And so they began to tighten, and they tightened ferociously. Absolutely ferociously. I mean, you rarely see in monetary history anything like this. Their interest rates went beyond the inflation rate. Their interest rates caused monetary aggregates to collapse. M1, the narrow definition of money went negative, -5% in an economy that whose nominal GDP was still 6 or 7% per annum. The broader measures of money went to maybe 4, 5, or 6%. Again, negative in terms of financing activity. Surely unable. I mean, the population at large could not service 40, 50, 60% interest rates. Those are consumer loans. They bear 40, 50, 60%. So with money barely growing, that had to result in widespread defaults. Right, and so they did that, and they applied that squeeze, and that squeeze is still on, and they began a little late, quite a bit late, I would say, because that's what central banks do. They are timid. They always will find an excuse for doing something that is a little difficult to do, and so they waited too long. That is what will happen, and that is exactly what will happen in our case. That will happen in the U.S., that will happen in Europe, that will happen in Japan. They are continuing to experiment. They are pumping money in different ways. They're doing some crazy things with the price of money. But eventually, the one thing that will stop them will be inflation going above a certain level. And when they, when that happens, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish off.
I'm saying when that happens, we will see them tightening and tightening in a big way. And our latest in the U.S., we have an example. We have actual example. We allowed inflation to get out of hand in the 70s for many years. We tried every conceivable way to bring it down, every conceivable way that doesn't work to bring it down, and it didn't work. And finally, we had a courageous central banker by the name of Volcker, and he raised interest rates to 21% or 22% short-term interest rates, well above the rate of inflation, kept it there for long enough to squeeze inflation out of the system, and he did. But it caused an incredible crisis, right? This is what's going to happen with central banks. They can only be stopped by something like that. Good.
Now, you've played the Brazilian move by the Brazilian central bank and have bought Brazilian bonds. And so far, that's a trade that's proved profitable, even with a hedge on the currency. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that, and I'd ask you when you finish to consider whether or not then central banks can be gained by you, and you feel that these kinds of late gestures will represent opportunity for you and for the investors in the fund.
Okay, let me start by saying that we anticipated the central bank would tighten and actually went short Brazilian securities in the past few years and made money. We made money being short in Brazil. And so I found a bit of a delightful irony to say, oh, you know, they've done now a good job and I can go back and on the long side of securities. But yes, I think that they took the lesson seriously. They are not letting go. Brazil is now going to experience a 4% drop in real GDP. 4% after last year. Last year was 2 or 3%, and this year is 4%. This is the worst depression for them since the 30s, clearly, without a doubt. And they're not relenting. They're still staying where they are. And we are seeing prices beginning to come down, and they already told us that this year they think the prices will come down to about 7% by the end of the year. By next year, they'll be back into the range of 4%. But it's pretty remarkable what they're doing. And so my thinking has been, you know what, with this kind of monetary policy, and when we began, those bonds were trading around 14. 10-year bonds were trading on 14.25%. Now they're below 13. They have moved now below the short-term bank rate, and so we have what's called an inversion in rates. That's good value. That's got to be good value because if they persist, and I think they will, and I think they will get the results they want to see, we will see inflation drop very quickly. We may get inflation to drop faster than they think, and maybe even lower than they think, depending how long they hold on. They stay on course. So I figure that rates, long-term rates, can go to about 8%. Maybe they can go lower. But that's, to me, it's a reasonable expectation. So being long those bonds yielding 13% today is still a good trade. I didn't want to take a chance on the exchange rate. It seems to me that that if they begin to lower rates, you might be able to see the exchange rate go down. It may not work that way. It may be that exchange rate will get stronger because you'll have an inflow of capital, an inflow of investment capital anyway, encouraged by the lower rates, and therefore the exchange rate could stay firm. But I wasn't looking for a play on the real. I was looking for a play on the long-term rates and on inflation. And to me, that was the best way to play it, the simplest way to play it. I mean, there are other ways, derivative ways to play it, but we try to stay away from derivatives because they're complex and normally you cannot shop around for the best price and you're stuck with a dealer's price and you lose money that way. So
now the
best that we can do is that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was saying you share this position, or this position in Brazilian bonds is shared by the global macro and by the asset allocation.
So too
is another position in gold, and specifically in gold miners, to the extent that liquidity allows. Can you talk a little bit about that, about your gold mining position?
Well, interestingly, the gold mining position is only in the asset allocation fund, not in the global macro.
I'm sorry, you have the gold. You have the gold.
We have gold in both. We have gold in both, correct. We have an exposure of about 38%, I think, the last number, in the asset allocation of gold bullion, and about 62% maybe in the global macro fund. It's large in the global macro fund. But the asset allocation fund has gold mining shares, which the other one doesn't have. And the reason is because we never felt comfortable enough with liquidity, with the size of the markets on these, especially when we started buying these stocks. They were trading very lightly. And even today, they are trading a little bit more actively, but not the junior ones, maybe the more senior ones like Newmont and Barrick. So we felt all along that miners will do a little bit better than the bullion. But bullion for the global macro was easier to trade in. It was more liquid, and so we stuck with that one. Both of these are doing well. I think that we're going to see this year. If we don't see new highs this year, we're going to come pretty close to seeing new highs. I believe that we will get to over $1,500 this year in the price of gold.
And this is because of an anxiety about inflation coupled with worries that in the event that there's no inflation but rather a debt deflation, gold will regain its moneyness because it's a debt that nobody else owns.
Right, exactly. There are a number of factors at play here. Number one is the idea that as the world gets deeper into debt, and I recalled the title of the book that I once republished called World in Debt. Was actually written in the Depression, and I found it one day. I don't know what I was doing, but I found this book and I decided to republish it. I think it's in the 70s. It's an excellent book, but it talked about a world in debt. So as the world gets deeper into debt, you want to be able to own money that cannot be defaulted on, and so gold has this natural quality that nobody can default on your gold. And so that's a very bullish thing. So the deeper we get into debt, I think the better gold will do over time. Then, of course, there is the possibility of inflation, accelerating inflation. We already begin to see commodity prices lift off their lows in mid-February, and we're making 5-month highs in commodity prices. And this is pretty much across the board. I mean, we're seeing it in metals. We're beginning to see it in grains. I believe that gold can answer both of those two concerns and become a valuable asset, let's say, in the next few years.
Let's talk a little bit about commodities. You have a proprietary diffusion index that you look at, and you've been calling for commodities to bounce off the bottom for a while now. How have you played that? Maybe you could expand on, for the listeners, how you're thinking about them and how you're playing the commodities trade.
Yeah. Well, our diffusion index is fairly simple. It's nothing extravagant, nothing complicated. By the way, we do very few things that are complicated and extravagant. I would say almost none because we don't understand them. So, very simple. We try to be very simple in our thinking. And this diffusion index that I put together that I've been using for 20 years or so, it merely says how many commodities are down vis-a-vis last year. Of the whole bunch of commodities that we can trade, how many are down vis-a-vis last year? And as you get less and less commodities down vis-a-vis the year before, or as you get more and more commodities being higher than the year before, I mean, the different ways of looking at it, you start seeing a certain divergence. And I noticed this divergence in January, February, actually in February, and to me it sounded like that's it. We have hit bottom. We have hit bottom for commodity prices, and we actually did. We started getting a little stronger, and maybe in February, March got even stronger, and now we're moving up. So there's a sense, to me at least, that And maybe the catalyst is this reflation again taking place in China that was missing in the picture. So global conditions are such today that commodity prices can do well. We also have some supply problems around the world. So I think that commodity prices can do well. Now, how do we play this? How do we play this? Well, the thing is, managing commodity markets is an art, and it's an art because they're not heavily traded markets. They're not markets like the S&P 500, where you can buy.
You're talking about commodity futures markets.
Commodity futures markets, correct. Mm-hmm. We don't buy physical markets, but commodity futures. S&P 500 futures, you can buy and sell thousands of contracts in 5 seconds without moving the price, basically. And you cannot do that with commodity prices. So commodity prices requires a certain amount of finesse. And that's number one. Number two, you need to be constantly on the alert in terms of what's doing better in terms of momentum. Which one is acting better, which one is acting worse, and how do you choose between them. So what I decided years ago is that I'd find a manager, a guy who has a very robust, a very strong, longer-term technical system. And I said to him, look, mid-February, I said to him, look, you can only go long. I only want you to go long. Find me the best situations and get into them. And I'm going to give you a certain limit of how much money you can use of the funds. So the manager gets me long, but he gets me long commodities that I don't necessarily have to get involved in terms of the analysis, the fundamental analysis, because we'll do it by momentum. And in the past few weeks, I think it's starting to do quite well, and I believe that it will make a major contribution to the fund. In other words, commodities was always an important contributor to our performance going back 15 years, and I think once again we may be in a situation where that can happen again.
Well, in the case of the asset allocation fund, the original conception was that the world be divided up into be segmented into asset classes of equity securities, debt securities, cash, commodities, and real estate. And so, commodities plays a very big has a very set and specified role in that strategy.
Correct. And 40% of the fund is investing in commodities, actual commodities, gold and platinum. So
the,
a lot easier to manage that one. Yes.
The commodities market covers a very broad swath of assets. You have been short oil for a long time, made a tremendous trade in oil in 2015, and covered almost at the lows. It's one of the reasons, not perhaps the main reason, but certainly one of the main reasons that the fund is up 35% year over year. Where are you now with oil?
We're out of oil. We're neutral, don't have a position. We're neither short nor long. I may have some ideas where it may be going, but not strong enough to convince me to put on a trade. I believe that, number one, oil is participating in this general better feeling about commodity prices, and therefore it's you know we now see nearby Brent around $45, nearby WTI around 42 and a half. But I think that has to do with the better sentiment for commodity prices, be the fact that we went down a lot, so the market is entitled to a bit of a bounce, and see there's been some reduction in supplies around the world, especially in the fracking sector and in some of the other countries that are having a little bit of difficulty with supplies. So I think the combination is providing some support to the market, but it's extremely expensive, by the way, to be long gold, oil. Extremely expensive. It costs a dollar and a half a month if you want to buy nearby futures and roll them over every month. So it's like 4% of the price almost. It's just too expensive to bet on them now. I do think that the time will come that you will be able to put on a trade again, but this is not the moment.
In the past year, since the beginning of 2016, the best performing currency in the world has been the Canadian dollar. There's a very strong correlation between the Canadian dollar and oil, coupled with your view that commodities have bounced off the lows, is one way of playing the commodities boom in general, and perhaps the oil in particular, by buying Canada.
You know, we don't do. I don't like to do secondary trades. I don't like to do trades that are good because of something else. If I like that theme, I will go to the primary market. If I thought that the reason why the Canadian dollar is going up is primarily or maybe 100% the reason is because the price of oil is done better or is going to do better, then I'd rather buy oil. So I would think that the Canadian dollar then is a derivative, a secondary play on the market, and I don't have a view. That is provided, of course, that it is affected a great deal by energy prices. I think it is. I think it is, and I think that energy prices make a difference. I also think that commodity prices make a difference. Canada's terms of trade are probably the single largest factor in the price of the currency. But I don't have a view, and I would just, you know, stay out of it.
Okay, I want to circle back briefly to our discussion about debt. One of the trades that you have on in both the Global Macro and the Asset Allocation Fund, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, is in Greek banks. If there was a can we go back to even to Kerygmatic? If there was a Kerygmatic call to worry, it was yours about Greek banks at this time last year. Now you're long. What's up?
Right. So that has to do with our search for value. You know, we looked around and we said, look, where can we find value? And there are not that many places that one can find value. One of them, as I said, was this Brazilian long-term bond. But where else can we find value? And here and there you'll find it. But the Greek banks were sort of interesting because, generally speaking, the financial institutions, banks are trading at discounts to their book value. And that's unusual. We haven't seen that in many years. We saw that in 2009, 2008 during the crisis. But generally speaking, banks trade at 1 to 2 times book easily. The around the world, we are trading below book. And European banks were trading around 80% of book, 75-80% of book. The Greek banks were trading at 25% of book, 20% of book. Now, 20% of book, we know that, and they were recapitalized 3 times. They were recapitalized 3 times. And when you recapitalize a bank, you do it because, you know, the loans on their books are bad and they probably wiped their capital. And so I have to assume that the recapitalization, I have to assume, we don't know details, but I have to assume that a lot of the bad loans have been provided for. A lot of it has been provided for. And whatever has not been provided for, it's already discounted at a huge discount to book. So my guess is that – and all of the four banks, the four largest banks are in the same condition. So I have to assume that the four banks represent fairly good value. Now, if I believe that the country will continue to exist, and there's a lot of people around here who tell me, look, Greece is going to blow up. It's not going to exist anymore. Well, okay. But if Greece continues to exist, and it is a strategic country in Europe, so much so that the Germans have now changed their minds about Greece, and they think that Greece is important for them because of this migration problem, and they're willing to support them in many respects. They're willing to give them money. They're willing to support their application for credit. I believe that the picture has changed, whereas Germany at one time was very much against this Greek shenanigans. The Germans have come around and said, look, we got to support Greece. And Greece is important for NATO purposes. Greece is important as a containment to Russia, as a containment to Turkey eventually. So it is an important country, and I don't believe that they will allow it to collapse. So if you believe that's the case, and I think that the terms of forbearance with Greece will continue to be soft, and maybe they'll let them out of the euro in an easy way. I don't know. I can't picture. I cannot tell you because there are many different probabilities. But I believe that Greece will survive, and if it survives, it's got to have a banking system, and we got the four largest banks. So I can't imagine that buying them at 20 or 25% of book one can lose a lot of money. But my upside is pretty good. I think that I can see those banks trade back to 60 or 80% of book. And with a little bit of improvement in the economy, you can see maybe a 300%, 400% gain.
Now, you had a good quarter. You had a better quarter in the unleveraged asset allocation fund than you did in the leveraged global macro fund. And as you said earlier, one of the things that you don't do in the asset allocation fund is look for opportunity on the short side as you do in the global macro fund. Let's talk about the worst trade that you had for the quarter. And I assume that without looking at the sheet, that it was your short positions in the global macro fund, in particular in India and emerging markets. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I thought so, too. I thought so, too, until I saw the numbers. Actually, our worst trade for the quarter was our long position in Nikkei. Until we liquidated the Nikkei, we had experienced. I think the cost was probably in the area of 180 basis points. No, I'm sorry. The cost was 1.8%. The cost was 1.8%. That was the cost of the Nikkei liquidation. So from the beginning of the quarter to the end of the quarter, and interestingly enough, the next two were housing stocks. So again, long position. So no, our short portfolio did relatively well, even with the rally in the second half of the quarter. So that's where we lost money. And interestingly, by the way, we went back. We have now been going back into the Nikkei because I think the story remains a good story. It's a very good story, which is the central bank is basically getting rid of all government debt. Someday they will. You understand that the central bank, when they buy that debt, they earn the interest on that debt. And they give the interest back to the government, and the government uses that money to pay debt interest on the debt. It's a circular thing. It's completely circular, right? And in essence, what the government has done is has eliminated the debt via monetary emission. So
eventually they'll retire the debt. They don't have.
That's right. So they don't even need to retire. It's one pocket to the other. And so Japan that looked at one time horrible because they had so much debt. Well, soon they won't have any debt. Now that's one thing. And then the second thing is that debt is trading at negative rates. So what will big pension funds do that have to earn 4, 5, or 6% a year? They can't buy that debt. They have to sell that debt, and they can only buy one thing. Really, one thing they can only buy is equities, and equities, generally speaking, do yield positive returns, 1 to 2% anyway, and on an earning yield basis, I think you're talking close to 7, 6, 7, 8%. So, to me, logic is that the large institutions in Japan will sooner or later reconcile themselves with the idea that they got to own equities. So the story is still good, and so we're going back there. As far as the housing stocks, we remain long. We just remain long. The story is the same. Actually, the story gets better because the shortfall, the housing shortfall, the rental shortfall, the for owners shortfall is still very large and growing every year. We have not built enough housing since the 2009 cycle, since the 2008 recession. So the story gets better. And so we have held on to those positions. But it's those positions that caused our greatest loss.
Al, pleasure to talk to you, especially a pleasure to talk to you after a good quarter. We try and keep the call to about 45 minutes, and we've exceeded the limit by just a few minutes now. I want to, before I go, remind listeners that the call will be posted on the Friedberg and the Niagara website within a couple of hours. So you can check it out on your elliptical machines at your leisure for those of you who want to pass it on. Al, on behalf of all the investors, I wish you a very good second quarter. And thanks very much for your time this morning.